What's up, everybody? We are back with another episode of Pound for Pound. We are here at the beautiful Fountain Blue here in Las Vegas, Nevada. As always, I am the Nigerian Nightmare, Kamaru Usman.
The one and only, the triple C, the greatest combat athlete of all time, Henry Cejudo. I just had to throw that in there, Kamaru.
Yes, and we are back. And today we have a very, very special guest. A guy that I ran into a long time ago. I don't know if he'll remember the story, but I met some years back, and I didn't really pay attention to the name until my man started making waves. I'm like, oh man, I ran into that dude. I know that dude. It's my man, former IBF super middleweight champion of the world, Mr. Caleb Plant.
Yo, appreciate you.
A Shot of Lime production.
My man, you know we met before, right? You remember that?
Yeah. I think it was at Catch.
Yeah, we met at Catch. 2019, I believe. Was that 2019?
Like 2020, I think. Something like that.
2019, because 2020 was pandemic. It was 2019. It was the night of my fight. I think it was the night of my fight. I just fought Colby Covington the first time. I'm all bruised up, lip busted up and everything. And I'm in, it's me and Ali, just us two. It was the night after. And we're at Catch eating. And you were with Uriah Faber. And you guys walked up and Uriah introduced you. And Uriah said, hey, this is my man Caleb, about to be world champion. And at that point, I follow boxing, but not religiously. So. Yeah. Loosely follow boxing, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. It was and we met. It was cool. It was a nice meeting, and we went on about our day. But I do remember something about that. I was like, oh, you know, that dude kind of, you know, he was kind of drippy. You know, he had the black jeans on. He had like a shirt. You know, you be having a nice shirt, so I can tell you had the shirt on it and the hat. I was like, oh, you kind of dripped out. Okay, you got some style on it. Our first meeting.
I remember, and just want to come over, you know, pay my respects, tell you good job, champ, and, you know, wishing you well. So
thank you. Appreciate that, man. It was, since then, been a hell of a career, hell of a road.
Yeah, a couple ups and downs, but, you know, when you're constantly getting in there with the best and, you know, rolling the dice with the best, you know, sometimes you're going to get your hand raised. Some other times, you know, you might come up a little short, but, you know, with me, that's what I'm looking to do. You know, I want to keep getting there, rolling with the best, like you yourself, you know, that's what it's about. So I'm not interested in, you know, everybody wants to be undefeated, but if it comes at the price of never facing the best out there, you know, what's the point?
Yeah. And I feel, Caleb, like with your story, obviously I've seen, you know, your countdowns with Canelo, with Benavidez, and I think what I find ironic with your story is how you're raised, man, and kind of like the upbringing that you've had, the struggles as a family. And, you know, boxing wasn't your first love. You know, it was a sport of kickboxing, as your dad was you know, really good at what he did.
Oh, snap. He kicking too?
Yeah, no, and obviously, I think the hardships that you have gone through, even to the fact that to the point where, you know, where you're raised, it's like you guys didn't have a ring. Nah. So the people would have to literally get together. Whoever was scouting, they would literally have to hold hands. So you guys had a resemblance, a little bit of what a ring was.
Yeah.
I mean, talk to me a little bit about the upbringing and what is it that's made you Caleb Plant?
Well, yeah, just speaking to, I first started off kickboxing, and I won the IKFs. I've been in the same tournaments with a Wonder Boy. He's been knowing me since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And it was full contact kickboxing. So no kicks below the waist. You know, all you got to do is throw six kicks per round. And, you know, you come out and throw six in the first minute and you could just box the rest around if you wanted. So that's what I started off doing. And I got 5 world titles and 9 national titles in kickboxing. I've been to Italy with Team USA, Trinidad with Team USA, and, you know, done, you know, international duels across the US as well. And then I really just started boxing to help my kickboxing. And then I would just be doing it simultaneously. Like one weekend I'd be kickboxing in a tournament, you know, 2 weekends later, I'd be at a little 2-3 day boxing tournament in Atlanta. and just weekend after weekend, just driving all over the country, just trying to get the experience. And then it got to the point where I was like, man, I really don't want to kickbox anymore. You know, like, I feel like the talent pool in boxing was deeper than the talent pool in kickboxing. And not to mention, I knew like turning pro in kickboxing wasn't going to really be a thing for me because you don't really make any money.
Don't make the bag.
And I'm not trying to do anything else besides fight. So, yeah. So I went to my first adult national tournament, the age group of 17 to 34. I went to the USA Nationals at the Olympic trial, at the Olympic Training Center.
Yeah.
And I placed third, made Team USA. And after that, I was like, man, I'm not kickboxing no more. This is all I want to do. And I've just been.
So just naturally, you're able to just transition. So you already had hands. I mean, obviously, were you dominant more?
Like, yeah, always better with my boxing and just boxing to help my kickboxing out. So it's not like I just made the switch overnight. You know, when I turned 17, it was like, since a kid, I had been doing both, you know, weekend after weekend. So it wasn't ever an issue for me to just box this weekend and just kickbox that weekend and like keep up with the rule set or anything like that. But yeah, once I got to 17, I'm like, man, the boxing is for me. That's all I want to do. And just been riding it out ever since. And then speaking to the gym, it was like, it may have been no bigger than this room, you know, damn near. And it was just a white tile floor. No mat. So, you know, when we get to sparring, it gets sweaty. People start slipping, boom, falling. And it would just be with tape on the floor, a square. And then when we spar, we just stand around it like that as ropes. So, you know, we're not crashing through the wall. There was like holes in the wall and stuff. Just one heavy bag in the corner. You couldn't even work all the way around. But, you know, like I said before, you know, when you really want something, when you're really passionate about it, you don't have to have all the greatest technology. You don't have to have all the latest gear. Like if you want it bad enough, you know, guaranteed you're going to get there, so.
Yeah, but now you do. Look at you. Look at Kamaru, man. Kamaru, dude, he's nothing but Gucci.
Chill. Hey, we still got a long way to go here. Hey, no, but it's that's an interesting thing that you said because it's that's a thing now is all these people coming out, all these kids coming out, and they feel like, oh, no, I got to be in the best facilities. I got to be, had a, you know, this. I had to have that. I got to have all these, you know, five squat racks in a weight room and in this and that, which you really just, and then they get it, you really don't need it, and then they get in fights and they're getting beat by someone from a small place in Nicaragua who just has a room that doesn't even have a gym, has a room and is borrowing gloves to train with and come in there and just spank them. It goes to a test of that, just that mentality.
Yeah, and I think it comes from, you know, the people who can afford all that. You know, that usually means they also have other options in life as well, you know, as opposed to the guy who's in Nicaragua, you know, and he has no other options. There is no choice for him to fail on his mission. You know, he's got to make it. His life depends on that. And when your life is dependent on something, guaranteed, you know, you're going to find a way to make it happen with or without, you know, the latest gear. So,
yeah,
I'm a big believer in that.
Because I almost feel like when you have guys like Roberto Duran, who grew up in the gutters, Julio Cesar Chavez, who grew up, you know, in the pedals. Manny Pacquiao had to kill his damn dog to survive for his family. I mean, it's those harsh upbringings, the guys who have really lived life at such an early age that has matured them into freaking world champions. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's almost like, has your past become your greatest weapon?
So, you know, I'm not going to act like I've had it worse than some of those guys you mentioned. There's plenty of people in the world who had it worse than all of us, you know? So, but at the same time, you know, it's not a whole lot going on where I'm from, you know, and we did grow up in quite the poverty. You know, there's been times where, you know, I have stolen things to have to eat, where I have had to do things, take things, you know, do things that I didn't necessarily want to do to just to have to see another day, you know? And, but you know, when you come from the bottom, you know, really the only way is up. So you just gotta keep putting one foot in front of the other, you know. And sometimes you have to do things you don't necessarily want to do for the greater good of getting to where you gotta get. And you know, I'm blessed to be here and blessed to be able to, you know, even though I come from the country, I am a country boy from way out in Tennessee. You know, to be able to say that I've made it to the big leagues in boxing, like, you know, that's legendary where I'm from.
It's something about you. I'm very big on energy. I like to, even with my opponents, I like to read their energy. And that's when guys fight, when I'm watching their film, It's not necessary. Of course, I watch the techniques, what they're good at, what they're not good at, but it's, I like to watch their energies. And it's like you, or when I'm around you, I feel a certain energy. And I felt it even when we first met. Especially when we're fighters.
Yeah.
It's a different, we have a different sense, different read on people. And you give off this energy to where you have a chip on your shoulder. It's like, and that's not necessarily a bad, that's not a bad thing. It's this chip on your shoulder. Like, it could be taken of, I'm going to show them. I'm going to show them that person doubted me. That person doubted me. I'm going to show them. And you carry yourself to me as having that chip on your shoulder. Is that a fair assessment to, or are you just, type of dude I don't really associate?
I mean, I'm determined. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if that's the vibe, then, you know, I guess I could agree with that. I'm determined on getting where I'm headed, you know. And, you know, I have had a lot of people who don't believe in me, you know, being from where I'm from out in the middle of the country and, you know, honestly being a minority in boxing, you know, I've had a lot of people tell me what I can do, what I can't do, you know, what I can, where I can wind up, you know, cementing myself in boxing and where I can't. And I'm sure you guys have been told the same thing, you know, and when you get enough people telling you can't, but you got your mind made up that you will, it really just adds fuel to the fire, you know, of wanting to prove them wrong and more importantly, prove yourself right. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure, yeah, I definitely carry a chip on my shoulder, but, you know, that's gas in the tank, you know, it's gotten me here, so.
Yeah, because I also know that, you know, you had a great amateur career, but you also fell a little bit short of making the Olympic team.
Yeah.
Olympic alternate. I don't know if it was 2012 or 20. Yeah, 2012. Yeah, I was 08. We're 2012.
Where did you when did you come? You came to the training center for trials? What year?
Well, the USA Nationals was at the at the Olympic Training Center, and then
what year was that?
Then in 2011, I went to the Golden Glove Nationals. I won the Golden Glove Nationals, so that's the Olympic trial year. I made the Olympic trials.
Yeah.
And then I wound up losing to the Olympian by 2 points. And
at that weight, who was the Olympian at that weight?
Terrell Gachet.
Oh yeah, Terrell Gachet.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was at the train. I was a resident at the training center at that point.
Yeah.
And I was deep. Well, not deeply, but I knew of the guys because I was there every day.
Yeah.
And I was starting to kind of fall in love a little bit with boxing. You know, I was seeing a boxer at the time, so
yeah.
I watched some of the practices.
Yeah, you know, I knew Andre, like, was there.
He was in 08.
He was in 08. I remember, yeah. Rasheed Warren.
Yeah.
You know, I remember watching Marcus Brown.
Yeah.
Watching Terrell Gachet come through. I remember watching JoJo Diaz.
JoJo, yep.
You know, I remember seeing all of them. You know, Errol Spence.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, so I was. You would have stuck out for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. But I did go there for a training camp at the Olympic Training Center. They got there before me because they was, you know, the priority. But wound up getting to the Olympic Training Center and finishing out camp with them before we went over to London to, you know, finish everything up. So, yeah, that did hurt, you know, losing to Terrell. And especially in the way, too, because, like, there was confusion on the judging. Like, I came back, I sat down after the first round, and the guy helping my dad was like, yeah, you know, you won that round. Just keep doing what you're doing. Then I came back after the second round. He was like, no, actually, you lost the first round.
Mm.
And now the second round was, like, close. Yeah. So in the third round, I had to really go out there and, like, pick it up.
I hate that. And
I wound up losing by 2 points. But, you know, it's probably, you know, for the best that things, you know, turned out how they did, because that just kept adding to the fuel of, like, man, I'm that close from getting where I wanted. I just got to keep pressing on. And so, yeah, I did this thing called the WSB as well. It's like 5 rounds, no headgear. And it's like teams from all over the different world, you know, all over the world.
Was that the thing that Lomachenko?
Yeah, he was in it. Usyk was in it. And I did that as well. And I had a fight in that against Argentina 2013. And then I turned pro in 2014. Signed with Al Haymon and my manager Luis de Cubas, and my pro debut was on Bermain Severn versus Chris Areola and at the USC Galen Center in LA. And just been grinding since there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do have to ask this, but obviously you become world champ, you know, after all those trials, after this kid, you know, who came from where he came from, Olympic alternate, you know, still sticking around, became pro a couple of years after the Olympic trials to you eventually becoming a world champ. Talk to me about that fulfillment.
Man, like
one of the happiest days of your life, if not at that time, if not the.
Yeah, one of the most like fulfilling moments for sure. You know, just to hear the words "and the new" for the first time. I don't know if there's anything like that.
Yeah.
And you know, especially, you know, everything that I had to go through to get that. I mean, even, you know, with my daughter and everything, and just you know, just want to fulfill that promise that I had made to her. And you know, she wasn't with me anymore, so you know, knowing that I won't be able to do a lot of things for her as a father, but if I could just, you know, keep that promise, that was weighing on me for sure. And so to be able to fulfill that and keep that promise, you know, that meant a lot.
Yeah. To before we obviously I want to hear more about that, but it's something about when you become a father as a man, what it does to you. What Henry just mentioned just now is when you hear that "and new" for the first time, it does something to you as a man on a mission, a man with a purpose, psychologically does something to you when you hear that, when you recognize all the hard work, everything that I've put into this. This is what I wanted, what I controlled, what I worked for, and I got it. It does something to you psychologically.
Yeah.
You know, nothing else can give you. Obviously, you have different feelings. Like you get married, you have a wife, you have children. All these are different motivators, but nothing else feels like that.
No, I mean, I couldn't even keep it together. Like, I just hit my knees and just, you know, speechless, really, you know, just bursting into tears because just everything I had, you know, I mean, everything from like, you know, at one point I was homeless, staying in an abandoned office building back where I'm from, and just trying to not sleeping on a futon in the back room and having to navigate that, having to navigate eating and driving, you know, 45 minutes to training every day and in this Jeep that, like, I'm not exactly sure what was wrong with it, but it'd be like every time I drove it, it would get me to where I'm going and then it wouldn't start up. I'm not sure if it was the fuel pump or the water pump. And I used to drive that thing to the gym all the time, knowing that when I get ready to leave the gym, it's not going to start. And sometimes I would spend hours out there trying to get a start. And sometimes my friends would have to drive me 45 minutes back home. And it's like, at the time, I'm like, man, I don't care how I get home from the gym. I don't care if I can't get home from the gym. Like, all I know is that I just got to get to the gym. And one day, you know, I'll be able to have any car I want. And so just navigating through all those things, and from my childhood and everything that happened to, you know, as a young man, you know, a younger man, you know, being homeless and having nowhere to stay, and, you know, just trying to finagle through the world, like, for me to hear those words "and the new," it's like, not only does it make all those things worth it, but it's like sometimes you get made out to be crazy for believing in yourself to a certain extent. And just to be able to say, you know, you don't walk around telling everybody "I told you so," but just in your head knowing, like, "I told you all." You know, I tell my teachers, they'd be like, "Well, what about a plan B? What if boxing doesn't work out?" I'm like, "Well, what if teaching don't work out? What the fuck are you going to do?" You know what I'm saying? Like,
it's like,
you know, what do you mean if it don't work out? It's going to work out. I'm going to make it. And to be able to bring that to fruition is just different. Yeah.
And on the flip side of that, when you do become a father, something like that, that's a different feeling. It's a different motivation. You understand that it's not necessarily all about just me anymore. It's not my purpose anymore. You know, I have to, it's still my purpose, but I have to now, there's a different motivator that's thrown in the mix. And talk a little bit about your child that you lost.
Yeah, because you ended up, once you won the world title, you ended up going to the cemetery, right?
To bring her the belt, you know, just, well, my daughter, she, Aaliyah, she was born in 2014, and everything seemed to be like it was on track to be good. But when she came, you know, she was kind of acting funny or showing signs of things being different. And so they, you know, took her off to run some tests, and very shortly after that, you know, got news that she had a lot of issues going on with her. You know, she had a lot of gray matter in her mind, you know, a lot of, like 150, 200 seizures every single day. You know, she had brain damage. She couldn't sit up. She didn't have any motor skills. She couldn't sit up. She couldn't eat. She had to eat through a Mickey tube in her stomach. You know, ate medicines twice a day. Doctor's appointments every week, like on life support 5 different times, like have to go to the hospital and stay there for weeks, wake up and be in camp and still have to be sleeping at Vanderbilt Children's Hospital in Nashville. Wake up, you know, go train, have to come back to the hospital and be with her, go to strength and condition and come back, go home, get more clothes, get everything you need, switch out your gear, come back, bring more clothes. I had to shower there, eat there, and, you know, hospital food's not really all that. And, you know, while a lot of my competitors, when they're in camp, you know, they're at home, they have, you know, the fixings, you know what I'm saying? They have everything they need right in front of them to ensure that they have a great camp. And just an uphill battle for 19 months, really. Just, she was struggling, and I think it just became to be too much on her. And the last time she was on life support, just understanding that this time may be different, and going to her bedside, just letting her know, like, you know, if this is too much for you, if this is, you know, not something you want to do anymore, you know, I don't want you to think dad's going to be mad at you or upset. And, you know, it's not like she could understand me, but at the same time, you know, you just want to get that off your chest with her. And so just letting her know that. And then, you know, shortly after, she, you know, started going downhill, and that wound up being, you know, that moment. So,
yeah, yeah. You get me right now, because we're both fathers and we both have daughters. So, and I remember the first time my daughter had a cold.
Yeah.
She had a cold and she was acting different, you know, and I'm like, oh, it was hard to see that. So I can't even imagine having to be in a hospital and watch this each and every day.
It was tough for sure. And, you know, I'm like 21, 22 as well, and I'm not pro yet, you know, so I'm having to, you know, I didn't have the hardest job, so I'm not complaining. But, you know, at the same time, it was difficult being that young of a guy and having to carry that responsibility, the financial, you know, paying for some things that you got to pay for. But, you know, when it's your baby, you know, you're going to figure out a way to get it done, good or bad. You know, you're going to come through and you're going to pull through for your kids. So as difficult as it was, I feel like that's probably something that had to happen to me to be able to give me that type of motivation to just to keep going, you know. And then obviously after she passed, you know, now I'm really in go mode. Like, there's nothing that's going to stop me from accomplishing what I told her I was going to accomplish. Because when she's here, you know, just sitting with her, talking to her, telling her what I'm going to be, what I'm going to do, and about future plans. So I needed to see that through.
Yeah. I think, you know, obviously you finally become a world champ. You know, you put that, you fulfill that promise, that dream that you set out to do. And not just that, but, you know, that promise that you gave to your daughter. And then finally the biggest fight of your career comes. You know, finally you get an opportunity to go up against one of the greatest of all times, and Canelo Alvarez, man.
Yeah.
You know, you finally get that big shot, man, with the big kahuna, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
You know, how surreal was that to be able to finally say, okay, I've worked this hard. I got the IBF world title. Now it's time to unify it against Canelo Alvarez.
Yeah, I mean, after my world title fight, I had 3 title defenses, voluntary the next one, and then my mandatory against Vincent back in my hometown in Nashville at the Bridgestone Arena. He was the WBA regular champ at one point. And then I fought former world champion Caleb Truax after that and defended my title. And then that's when the Canelo fight came along. And, you know, a chance to fight for Undisputed doesn't always come around. And then with, you know, getting to fight Canelo on top of that, you know, that's like the Super Bowl when you mix him and become an Undisputed. So I just felt like, man, this is what I've been working for. You know, this is my moment to really go in and plant my flag as, you know, a legendary fighter. And obviously, you know, things didn't go my way. But, you know, at the same time, I didn't put up a type of performance where I'm like tucking my tail and, you know, running and hiding and embarrassed by that. You know, I put up a good fight. And then in the end, you know, I went out on my shield and, you know, he dropped me. I got back up. Then, you know, he dropped me again. I got back up. I'm telling the ref, like, no, I'm trying to keep going. But, you know, the ref did his job and, you know, he protected me from myself. You know, some fighters are too tough for their own good and, you know, willing to go out on a platter. And obviously I'm one of those guys. So, you know, the ref did his job that night. Canelo did his job that night. But, you know, at the same time, I'm looking to run it back. You know, yeah. I'm looking for me and Canelo to run it back. And, you know, he told everybody, like, hey, y'all need to start fighting each other. Like, everybody right. wants to fight me. Right. You know, why don't y'all get to fighting each other? So, you know, I've been doing that. You feel yeah. me? So yeah. That's a position I want to work myself back into. I don't need to be handed anything. I don't mind going and working for something. So,
yeah. Being in there with Canelo, because he's short, man. He's relatively short, man, especially for super middleweight, man. You guys are, mm-hmm. Canelo's what, 5'8"?
5'8", 5'9", probably yeah, something like that.
He's not that big, man. Whatever it is that he says, what did you feel? What did you notice that made a guy like Canelo just different?
Probably just the experience. Yeah. You know, the experience. You know, that's not something you can buy. You can't get that in training. You got to walk through the fire to get that. And, you know, that experience isn't coming until you go and get it. So I feel like the biggest thing for me was just getting that experience. You know, I had like 21 fights maybe going into that. And so, but, you know, I feel like I've gotten that experience. And since then, I fought former two-time world champion Anthony Durrell. And you know how that went.
It's funny because I was watching that Canelo fight closely because I was campaigning for that fight.
Yeah.
I really wanted that. Hey, we were in talks. The thing is, exactly what you said earlier, you know, a lot of the, and that's it. And I want you to, in a minute, I want you to explain this because a lot of people, a lot of fans, a lot of fight fans, MMA fans don't understand the belt system, don't understand how there's four different champions in the same weight classes. And if these guys don't want to fight each other, they're just going around, oh, I'm champion, I'm going to fight my mandatory, and just a state champion. And so, but, you know, I was watching that fight. I'm like, because Canelo's like, oh, well, you guys have to start fighting each other, you know, because y'all just waiting for me. And I'm like, what's up? you know, I'm not a boxer. I'm not trying to go 12.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're walking through these guys. Let me give you a different look. You know, at least for four rounds. We go get it in for four rounds. After that, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know for four rounds. So I was watching that fight. And I think it was a great performance. I do think you started off very, very well. I think you are one of the, you know, especially in those upper weights, I think you are one of the most technical fighters in those division. And, you know, after the Canelo fight, what I like is, you're right, it is experience when you go through something like that. Because now I started to see you kind of, it's almost a different chip on the shoulder. Like, okay, here we go. And then Anthony Durrell, who I am, you know, I like Anthony Durrell. You know, I did watch, I grew up kind of knowing of the brothers. Obviously, while I was in that, in the Olympic Training Center, once I started to get more and more into boxing. So I do like Anthony Durrell. Cool dude, you know, also a great golfer as well, you know, as I've come to realize. But, you know, in that fight, there was a lot of bad blood, a lot of things were said. And this goes to just attest to what I was saying earlier with this chip that you have on your shoulder, because it was almost like you said, you're a minority in boxing.
Yeah.
And it was this, I don't know who said what or what was said, but it was like, oh, I'm not finna lose to no white dude. I think maybe that was a comment. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah,
but you went out.
They probably said that to each other, man. Canelo what? And him.
What?
No, white dude.
When he was about to fight, when you were about to fight, Durrell.
Yeah, I think he had posted something on his page of Bernard Hopkins talking to Joe Calzaghe.
Yeah.
When Bernard Hopkins told Joe Calzaghe, I'll never lose to a white boy. I'll never lose to a white boy. And then, you know, just 2 weeks before, or, you know, don't quote me on 2 weeks, but shortly before we're about to fight, he's posting that on his page.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be posting that on your page unless that's what you're saying.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I seen it.
Oh, so you went.
Oh, yeah, I seen it.
Oh, so you one of them. You got to know. If they saying anything, I want to know.
You know, it's fuel. What people got to understand is, you know, boxing is not based off this. Fighting is not based off. Because there's great fighters from all over the world. You know, I'm looking at two of them, and y'all look way different. You feel me? So I feel like a lot of today's society bases people off what they look like, is based off what they can do, what they can accomplish, how good they are. And, you know, in 2024, we should be past all that. Nice. And so when I seen that, amongst some of the other things that he had said, some on camera, some behind closed doors, I just felt like it was my duty to teach him a life lesson that that's not how the world operates. You know, that's not how it works. It's not about what you look like. You feel me? It's about what's in here. It's about how hard you work. And that's what I love about fighting is, you know, even someone like Francis, look at where he's from, look at where he started. But fighting don't care about that. The only thing fighting cares about is how hard you're willing to work to obtain that goal that you want to accomplish. So I definitely had, not only coming off a loss against Canelo, but he definitely added fuel to fire by, you know, the way that he went about everything. But, you know, we buried that.
So. Yeah, I mean, Anthony's a great champion, you know. I'm a fan of his as well. But yeah, that was a hell of a fight. And of course, I already knew you could fight, you know, you becoming world champion and then start to kind of loosely follow you. And then you fought Canelo and saw that. And then you fought him. I'm like, yo, y'all better stop playing with this boy before he go out here and do something bad to y'all.
Yeah.
And I seen that. I'm like, oh, I think that put a lot of people on notice, especially from you being, you know, quote unquote, a white boy.
Yeah.
That put everybody on notice. Like, this white boy can fight. Y'all better stop. Yo, he allowed to come to the cookout because he,
if you look back through the history of boxing, there's a lot of white boys who can fight.
Facts.
And so, you know, I just feel like that I'm not the only one. I didn't start this. You feel me? You know, you go back all the way to Marciano, you know, Toro Gotti. I mean, you know, what color is Lomachenko? You know what I'm saying? So is it just white Americans? Is that what y'all are trying to say? Or is it, you get what I'm saying? Because then you got to start nitpicking. And it's like, that's just not how it works. And so I'm not the first. And, you know, I'm trying to inspire somebody who looks like me so that I'm not the last either, you know. But whether you look like me or not, obviously I want to inspire you. But, you know, I'm sure there's somebody else out there who's going to wind up looking like me who think, man, if Caleb did it, if Caleb can do that, you know, shit, I can too. Oh, Caleb's from the country, but he still became world champ. Shit, maybe I can too, you know. And so I think it's important to, you know, just keep things in perspective. Like, race should not be the top priority for what people can and can't do. And so I'm glad I was able to shed some light on that during that time and during that fight.
Like you said, it's buried because he's a great dude. It's buried.
No, so it's literally buried. No, it's really buried. Yeah, no, that's what I meant.
And that's what I love about fighting is at the end of the day, that's what we do. We go in and we settle it and we stand up like men. We shake each other's hands and we keep moving.
No, that one was buried. Come on, I think you got the quote on that, dude. But anyhow, Caleb, I always wanted to ask you, man, because you're probably about one of the few guys or maybe one of two who has fought Canelo and David Benavidez.
Yeah.
How impressed are you with the Mexican monster? Did you watch that fight with Demetrius Andre? How he did a high caliber athlete, a two-time Olympian, amateur world champ, and what he was able to do and finish him within, what is it, 5-6 rounds?
Yeah, I mean, David, he's obviously a great fighter. You know, that's why I want to fight him in the first place. You know, that's what I've been doing is going on my own revenge tour, just trying to, you know, get it rolling there with the best. If you think you're great and you're at the top of the rankings and everybody else is calling for it and it's something that I think is interesting, we got to make that happen. And then, you know, obviously me and David, it's not like we're best friends or anything like that. So it just made for a more fun fight. But David, you know, he's a great fighter. He's a big fighter too, you know.
Yeah.
He's a big old boy. And he's able to use a lot of that to his advantage. But at the same time, on top of his weight, his height, his frame, you know, he's really quick. He's smart. And, you know, he's able to get rolling downhill on you in a way that it's hard to keep a big old boy like that off of you. So
it's almost like he has that Mexican heart of that durability of being, of having the 12 round fight where it's able to favor Mexican boxers, but then he has a technique, you know, of an African American boxer, just speed, power, going to the body, coming up top.
Yeah.
And obviously you cut it, his length, you know, the fact that he does use that jab, the fact that he wants to somewhat be in the line of fire, to be able to slip punches, actually be inside to actually hurt somebody.
Yeah.
When you see a fight between him and a guy like Canelo Alvarez, How do you break that fight down? And who is it that really has to make that adjustment?
I mean,
is it the older Canelo or is it the younger Benavidez?
I think Dave is athletic in some ways. You know, he's explosive. He's quick with his hands. But in some ways, you know, he's not the most athletic fighter. But it would be hard to say, honestly, you know. It'd be hard to say, you know, for a multitude of reasons. One, Canelo is great. You know, you can't take nothing from him. And but Dave is great as well. He's young. You know, Dave has got some good momentum right now. So it'd be hard to say. I know you're looking for a better answer than that, but.
No, I know that's your boy too. He's a fan of both of them. He wants to see that. Where are you from?
I'm from AZ. I'm from Arizona. I used to spar with David back when he was. I used to spar with David back when he was that chubby kid that people talk about.
Yeah.
He was about 250, bro, but he's 11 years old and I'm 10 years older than him. And I'm going, you know what I mean? Like, I'm going at it with this dude.
Yeah.
At that time he was a little shorter, but what his dad was able to do, like, these guys have ate, slept, boxing, and Jose Benavidez, you gotta give him credit. He's a fucking hard ass dude. He was my first trainer. And I would see his head. No, get up. Like, the kids, like, at times, super talented. Like, even Junior, I always felt like Junior, out of the two brothers with the most, like, super talented. Obviously, he went astray, did his whole thing, in my opinion.
Takes more than talent, you know?
Yeah, exactly, man. And I think that's partially what David, that really helped David get to where he's at today, is watching his brother, how talented he was, and yet seeing the potential that his brother had, but also learning from the mistakes that his brother actually did. And he was able to become the youngest super middleweight champion of the world.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I'm going to have to say those.
Me and Jose are well acquainted as well.
Yeah. Senior or junior?
A junior.
Oh, yeah? You guys going to scrap?
Huh?
You guys going to scrap?
Like box?
Yeah.
Nah, he ain't in my weight class either.
Yeah.
He's too small for me.
Yeah, so like those upper weights right now are a lot of action. Of course, you got the welterweights and you got the 140, but those upper weights too. It's a lot of action. Speaking of that, I gotta ask, because like I said, I loosely follow boxing, so I do remember, because I'm not big into my IG and fan, you know, stuff like, I just get on sometimes, you know. But I do remember being flooded one time, every outlet flooded by a left hook slap from hell and backstage somewhere. And I'm like, what is going on? Why? How is this happening? You know, talk about that a little bit. At least I just want to know what happened backstage that led to the events of you just... You know, we could call Dana, maybe sign him up for Power Slap.
Trying to get, like, on Power Slap, Caleb?
Nah, I ain't doing no Power Slap. I ain't standing with my hands behind my back.
But what happened with that situation? Like, how'd that come about?
I mean, you know, honestly, I spoke on that a couple of times. And really? So, you know, I don't want to get too much into the details, just so I don't, you know, keep hitting the nail on the head on that situation. But basically, I told him to keep his hands off me and, you know,
Oh, so he was putting his hands on you.
And he put his hands on me again. And so, you know, I had to fix that. You know, you can't walk around putting your hands on grown men. And if a grown man tells you to stop, and the only thing you can think to do is put your hands on him again, that means you want to fight.
Now, were you guys friends? So
it either means you want to fight,
yeah,
or it means this dude's a bitch and I know he ain't going to do nothing. It's one of the two. If you come up fucking in my face, that means either you want to fight me or you think I'm not going to do nothing. What else could it be? And then, you know, he's another one. As soon as after they've done that, oh, yeah, look at him, y'all scared. Look at him just like a white boy. Look at him bitching up, getting scared just like a bitch-ass white boy. And that's not how the real world works. You feel me?
That's not exactly what I saw backstage. Somebody who was scared. That's not what I saw.
Yeah, that's not what I saw neither.
And, okay, well, I mean, and he's in those upper weights. I mean,
yeah, he's at 160. And he just fought Jose Benavidez.
He missed weight for that.
He missed weight for that.
Bigger. So, I mean, what's the potential of a fight like that? Because I do believe that's a big fight.
Oh, yeah. That's a fight that we want to make happen.
Yeah,
and I mean. So, that's a fight that I've tried to make happen. That's the fight that I was looking to.
He ain't trying to move up to 68?
He's about to move up to 68. Yeah, he's about to move up to 68.
Yeah, I mean, after missing weight at 60.
No, his brother's 54.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after missing weight at 60, I mean.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The
so,
next volleyball option is why not just.
So yeah, run it with Caleb.
We need to make that happen. And unfortunately, it's not going to happen this next time like I want it. You know, he's off doing his thing and, you know, relaxing, chilling, whatever the fuck it may be. So, you know, I'm not going to sit around and beg somebody to fight me, and I'm not going to sit around and wait. Somebody fight me. I'm moving on. So yeah, it's definitely a fight that I want to make happen. And you know, it's just unfortunate, man. If you gonna say you're a grown man, you're gonna be hanging around a bunch of grown men, then you gotta act like a grown man. Because if you get to fuck around acting like a kid, you know, sometimes that means belt to ass. And I didn't go that way. I didn't go that way in for that.
Hey, clip that, cut that. Bar right there.
I didn't go to the weigh-in, you know, the Errol Spence, Terrence Crawford weigh-in for that. It was just me and my wife.
You guys were backstage.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I'm not going to get into too much details, yeah. But basically, I told him quit fucking
with me. You're gangster, dude, to be with your wife and still do some shit like that.
Hey. I mean, hey.
I feel like she thugged out too.
Nah, so... You know, it's just one of them things. You know, hopefully he can learn from that.
I mean, I don't mean, obviously, if it's, you know, like I said, I didn't know what happened. I just remember seeing that.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what?
But that was the second slap. That was the second slap.
Ooh, that was the second one.
Yeah, the first one worse than that one.
Wow.
Yeah. That second, the one you seen, was a 10 out of 10. The one you seen is a 10 out of 10. That first one, like a 14 out of 10.
Damn.
Yeah. But
all I remember is just hearing, bah! I was like,
I'm going to be like this talking to Kayla. What's up? Terrence Crawford, man, right now, he wants to fight. He wants a little bit of Canelo. Can a guy at 147 pounds with the skills that a guy like Terrence Crawford has, does he have the ability to go up to 168 pounds and actually compete or even beat a guy like Canelo? Obviously, you're in the boxing world, and as we know, there's weight classes in boxing. There's a reason why it goes up by 5 pounds, you know, to eventually 6-7 pounds. And wrestling, you know, this like the most competitive sports. You go up, you may be a world champ at 145 pounds. You go up the next 5 pounds, shit changes. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you give a guy like Terrence Crawford a chance against a guy like Canelo Alvarez?
I mean, hard to put anything past Terrence. You know, that's one of my buddies. And Terrence is such a bad dude. Like, it's really hard to put anything past him. You know, I would never say, oh, Terrence can't do that, because he's going to turn right around and go out and do it. You know, that's just the type of guy he is. But at the same time, you know, there are weight classes for a reason. And so... Canelo, he's not just some bum at 168 where it's like you're moving up and testing the waters, you know. Personally, I'd like to see Terrence maybe get like a tune-up fight or two as he moves up in weight to touch the waters, but that may not... If I had to guess, that's not really the type of guy Terrence is.
So maybe go 54, then 60. Okay, can you go with a guy like Canelo?
Whatever Terrence wants to do, I'm in full support.
He did talk about Little Charlo for a little bit, but then he's just like, after seeing that performance, I'm good. I'm good on that. I see that and I feel that. But you know, on this revenge tour, which is also the name of your clothing brand.
Yeah.
Which, like I said earlier, you know, he drippy with it. Now people might not. I mean, we got it. We're gonna get a close up of the details right here on the shoes.
The 85s.
You did that yourself?
These are 1985 Air Jordan 1s. You know, that's when the Air Jordan 1 came out.
Yeah.
Also, these are the original.
Yeah, there's a Ground Zero right here. So, and then one of my good buddies, he does things with shoes. So, you know, we spiced them up a little bit. But this is Michael Jordan, his rookie year, he broke his foot. And then Nike made him a rehab shoe where they can tighten it up to give him more support for his ankle. And so... I just felt like that'd be, not only is it 85s, but it's the rehab shoe. And because not very many people have those.
I don't know if walking around here in the streets with them on. I might have to. Hey, sure. Henry, you hold them down. I'm
just them yeah, those are you got. I know you have a big closet. When I was watching Countdown, I noticed you're a big collector. It's like Dana. Yeah. We're just at Dana's office maybe about a few weeks ago, and he's got a freaking collection like you wouldn't absolutely believe. But I mean, what shoes go for are absolutely crazy. Like, what's the most expensive pair you got, man? Where do they range from? I know after that Canelo payday, you probably.
Nah. I would make an NMs before that. I would make an NMs before that. Yeah. NMs after. But yeah, I mean, I got one pair of 85s that are probably like four racks. I got some other ones too in there. I got some 85 Kentucky Wildcat dunks. So some call fours.
Yeah.
Couple and nice ones in there.
That's something big for you, like the whole fashion and true life. Is that something that you always wanted to do, or is just kind of, you know, like we say, fighting is a vehicle for us to get into other things and other avenues.
I've always been into liking that stuff ever since I was a kid. It probably stems from like not having any of that.
Right.
And you know, it's like, man, I don't have this. I don't have the same shoes that, you know, the kids in my school have, and you know, I don't have you know, the same clothes. Like, I had one pair of running shoes, like some old Nike Shocks. They were white, but really they were brown because they were so busted. And they had holes in the bottom of the shoe. And every time I'd go running, they'd run holes in my socks because there was nothing there. And so just to go from that to be like, man, one day I'm going to have this, I'm going to have that, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to buy that. And so, you know, start to get a little money in your pocket and, you know, you go out and start, you know, getting the things that you'd always wanted as a kid, so. But yeah, the fashion too, you know, my brand Revenge Tour is something that after the Darrell fight that I dropped, because I felt like there were a couple names that I had in mind for a clothing line. Yeah. And I just felt like that after I lost to Canelo, the name Revenge Tour just popped in my head. I'm like, yo, this is it. And then after the Darrell fight, that's when I dropped my first, you know, my first drop. And it's been doing real good. I mean, like in the first year, it done like 115 in sales. So, and I feel like...
You brought us a couple pieces.
I'll get y'all some. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's just relatable, you know. Yeah. Your life is your revenge tour. You know, your life is your revenge tour for all your shortcomings that have happened to you, for all the times people told you that you can't, or, you know, told you that you won't make it. You know, I feel like everybody can relate to that. People telling them no, their shortcomings. And it's like, no, I'm going to show you. I'm going to get my revenge on life. And I think a lot of times when people think of revenge, it's like this negative vibe to it. But if revenge makes you do what you got to do, if it makes you a disciplined person, if it makes you, you know, wake up early and go to bed early so that you, because you have bigger things in mind for your life, you know, that's a sweet taste of revenge to me, you know. So I just feel like it's a relatable slogan and a lot of people can vibe with it.
Yeah, I like it. I really do. Now, you know, you are 31,
yeah,
30, about to be 32 in July.
Yeah.
Yeah, 32, about to be 32, you know, professional boxer, world champion, you know, has made money, married, 2019, again, you were blessed with another child. How is life for you now as a father, as a husband, and as also still at the pinnacle of the sport?
She was born last year, August 25th.
August 25th.
Yeah.
Last year,
Like 4 weeks before the Darrell fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
as a father, yeah. Father, husband.
Yeah.
Still at the top of the sport. How is life? What's the day in the life of Mr. Mrs.
You know, blessed that, you know, I get to spend a lot of time with my daughter.
Yeah.
And so it just waking up, training, you know, it's just a repeat. You know, 80% of the year of my day is like the exact same. I wake up, I train, go home, spend time with my family, you know, go, if I have to go train again, I train again. Or, you know, my wife has a brand as well, JP Athletics. It's a fitness brand. And she's going to be, you know, bringing out her first drop here real soon as well. So either we're working on our clothes, our brand, or, you know, being mom and dad, training. Sometimes I take the cars out. I got a couple old schools. I'm into muscle cars and classic cars. And that's really like, all my life consists of. I'm pretty boring dude. It's just like the same thing over and over. But that's what I like, you know. I like to train. I like to be with my family. So
that's not boring. I think that's freedom. That's not a lot of people. I know we basically conceptualize it like, oh, this is boring because we're a lot of what we do is chaotic. Yeah. We thrive and we
people
live in
chaos.
People mistake
peace for boredom.
Yes. Yeah. We live in that chaos all the time. And even a lot of, especially fighters in our position who reach the pinnacle, they have a hard time doing what you just said. They have a hard time just being at peace, being at home, being able to just train, go home. And it's having the ability to just train and go home. That's freedom.
Yeah,
it's not. It might seem boring because it's not. You know, it might not be us in the limelight doing this, fighting, doing all that. But there's a real art to that. That is hard. It's difficult as well to be able to master. It's not easy to do, especially when you're a fighter and you come off of being the, you know, big fighter. Everything is about you. Every second is about you. All this is about you. To where you come home and you're
just daddy and
you're just daddy and husband.
For me, like, it's really not that hard. I'm not like a huge fan of being outside of fighting. I don't really like being in the spotlight. You know, I don't like being the center of attention. I feel like until recently, over my last couple of fights, I feel like the boxing world has kind of got to know me a little bit more. Facts. But before that, I think that they mistake my quietness or like my reserve personality for like maybe cocky or like I'm better than people. But really, it's just like I don't really like being the center of attention outside of fighting. You know, when I get in the gym, when the lights turn on, that's a real part of me. You know, it's more outspoken, but I feel more comfortable in the gym. I feel more comfortable under the lights than a lot of times just being around in a room full of people. You know, a lot of times that'll keep me uptight and, you know, quiet. But it's like when the lights turn on, I get to like relax and really be myself. So it's really not hard for me to like just train and go home and just be with my family and not have to be like in the center. I don't really like moving like that. I don't have a big crowd or a big entourage. I got like just a couple handful, you know, just like a handful of friends that I really hang out with. And other than that, like, I like to stay out of the way.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Kamaru. So, because for those who don't know, this guy, he's a psychology major, you know, in psychology, which I'm sorry.
But we obviously it's
sociology. Yeah, sociology major. So it's you know, study the human behavior, you know, because obviously I think we all kind of grew up a little bit similar, you know, hardships. You know, I'm one of seven kids, immigrant mom, you know, grew up in poverty as well. But like having a kid, Kamaru, like, does that fix the void that we once had? Would that always kind of be in there? Is there always dent in us? Like, you know what I'm saying?
I don't think.
Like, do we, get rid of it? Like, obviously now we're parents, dude. He's a father. I'm a father.
Get rid of what?
Just the upbringing, the way we were raised and the way we kind of grew up. I mean, does having a kid fix some of that void that you had as a little kid?
No. I think it's those are the things that unknowingly shape you and kind of hardens you, your edges in a way to where you're sharp enough to be able to go through certain adversities that propel you to the top, you know, and like there's little things now I can recall moments in my upbringing and the moments in time for me even getting into sports that maybe something happened with the coach, something happened with my family, something happened at home that molded me into being this hard nosed, oh, I'm just going to work till I get to where I can show them. There's something about that. And you don't know that when you're in it. You don't know that. You're just like, oh, well, I have to drive to the gym and this Jeep ain't going to start today, but shit, at least I was able to get work in today. And you go home, somehow find a way to get back the next day. All these things mold you that propel you to hearing that and new. But then you have a child and I think the motivation shifts. It's not just about you anymore. You realize their life is in my hand. If I don't feed them, they die. If I don't go get it and my wife and them, they suffer. So it's a different type of battery that's put in your back that it's not just about me anymore, you know, because you can decide to quit on yourself whenever you want, but now it's not just you quitting on yourself, you're quitting on them.
And not only are you quitting on them, but you're teaching them to quit.
Facts.
Which is
facts.
Even worse.
Yes.
And I think it's important to, you know, show our kids that just because you come up short, that doesn't mean you quit.
Yeah.
You know, that means you got to get back up and dust yourself off and look in the mirror and see where you can change things and how you can make things better. And because, you know, when it comes time for them to want to quit and you quit.
Yeah, it's hard.
And they're saying, Dad, what'd you do? How did you do it? And you're going to have to sit there and you're either going to tell them the truth.
Yeah.
Or you're going to tell them some bullshit, which is even worse. You feel me? So
it's like I was deployed.
Yeah. You know, so it's just, it's important to, you know, even in your shortcomings, you got to get up and you got to dust yourself off in a graceful way.
Yeah.
Because that's the example that you're setting. And that's that, you know, our kids, you think your kids ain't going to be looking at every video that's ever been put out on you and YouTube. Yeah. At one point in their life, they're going to see that. And, you know, unlike a lot of people, a lot of our lives are recorded, and especially our biggest moments. And how we handle those big moments, whether you succeed or whether you fall short, you know, that's important because, you know, like you said, you got little ones looking at you, watching you, you know, they're learning from you. So you got to show them the right way.
Yeah. How important is that for you to be that role model?
It's everything, you know, like not every day as a professional athlete is easy. You know, I know it's easy for people at home. Well, if I made this much money, I would just, you know, but it's easy to say that once you're making that much money, but it's all the things you have to go through until you start making that much money. All the shortcomings and trials and tribulations, driving to the gym, knowing your car won't start. And, you know, it's important for me to show my daughter and my kids who aren't here yet, like, I want to handle it and handle myself in a way where, you know, 20 years from now, it ages gracefully, you know, it looks right. And so I try to keep shit like that in mind when I'm stepping out, when I'm the way I handle myself, the way I go about my business. And I think it's important.
Yeah. I knew it was the reason I liked you. No, I think I see that. I see the way you carry yourself. I see the way you move. You're conscious of your what you do. And I think that was the thing with me too, is it was a knock on me earlier in my career. It was just like, oh, he's boring. He ain't saying anything outlandish. He's boring. He's not doing a magic show at the press conference. He's not pulling a snake out of a hat at the press conference.
You gotta bring the gold giddy up out with the gold shoes.
Yeah, see, you know,
that's called business 101. Come on.
It is, which I get, but it was a thing where people feel like you mentioned earlier, just because you're more reserved and you're quiet because you're conscious of what you're putting out into the world, that, you know, some people, some fans might be, oh, nah, he's boring. Nah, he ain't this. Nah, he ain't that. No, it's just that. I'm conscious of what I put out into the world.
And I'm being me, you know, and sometimes that's digging a grave and sometimes that's being respectful, and both are genuine.
Yeah.
You feel me? But at the same time, like, when you come from so far from the bottom, there's not a lot of room for mistakes for you to still be able to make it. You know, when you're starting up here and you got to get to here, there's plenty of room for fuck ups. There's plenty of room for you to make the wrong decision and still get to where you're headed, because you're not starting from all the way down here. But when you're starting from the very bottom, you don't get to keep just fucking up and expect that you're still going to get where you're going. And so just my dad, you know, instilling that mindfulness in me from an early age and being so hard on me, I think, you know, yeah, I'm reserved because that's just really like my natural personality. But at the same time, like, you know, it is good to think about what you're doing, because, you know, if you're just out here flying by the whim, like just doing the first thing that pops into your mind, like you can expect to make mistakes. And if you make enough of them, you may not get where you're going. So,
yeah. So, sometimes you kind of wonder too, because I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the people that I had who were hard on me. And my mom in particular, you know, she's a tough love type of lady. But man, I don't feel that with my kid, man. It's hard for me to... You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, how can I pull some of what was given to me and give it to them? Or am I just off the beat here? You know what I'm saying?
Well, the thing that we say is, and I've talked about this before, is we always say, like, you hear parents say this all the time, is, I want to give my kids a better life than I had. But then the mistakes that we make later on once we have kids is we expect them to be able to deal and handle situations the way that we would handle them. But we're failing to realize the reason we're wise enough to handle these things the way we do is because of the hardships that we went through. But we're not putting them through those hardships. They're not going through that. So why do we expect them to have that mindset to handle and deal with those situations the way we do? So, Henry, yeah, you don't pour that into your kids. But the mistakes, and this is the problem that parents fall into later on, is once they're starting to get to a certain age,
hard to correct. Don't expect them to
be able to handle the situation the way that you would or the way you did.
And too, I feel like a lot of people mistake, is giving their kids things they never had.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not near as important as teaching them your shortcomings and trying to, you know, keep them from making the same mistakes you made. And, teaching them mindfulness in whatever way that may be, as opposed to just being so set on, like, I'm going to give them everything that I didn't have. Because honestly, that's not going to turn them into the person that, you know, well, I feel like all of it, at least, you know, us three here, like, we're going to be able to give our kids things that we never had because of the situation. So that's automatic off the top. So you really don't have to put too much emphasis on that, because we're naturally in better spaces than when we were kids. So it's like, you don't really have to put too much emphasis on that. I'm not teaching nobody how to parent or nothing, but that's just what I believe in. So I plan on, Charlie, she's in for it.
Yeah, she
got her the right daddies, because I feel like, you know, I don't know if I could be as hard on her as my dad was on me, but I feel like I'm going to be the dad that I need to be.
There will be love and discipline.
Oh yeah.
For sure. I
tell this story all the time, but when I was like 7 years old, I started playing football, little league, in pads, and I had like one bad practice. And my dad jumped the fence, come out on the field, yanked me up by my face mask, screaming in my face, throwing me down on the ground in front of the whole team. All of the parents, the other parents are like, shit, what the fuck? Yeah. Then on the way home, he's like, boy, if you ever have a practice like that again, I'm gonna make you quit football and sign up for cheerleading. And I'm like in the passenger seat, like, I don't wanna be a cheerleader. And, but I mean, yeah, my dad, he was really hard on me as a kid in like so many ways. He was always on me like that about everything. But, you know, sometimes maybe he took it too far, but in the end, I'm really happy that he was how he was on me, you know, to teach me what he taught me. And because, I mean, you know, I wouldn't be here without him. And I think, you know, we need to put more emphasis on strong dads, you know, in the world, because, you know, I feel like we're in a place where strong men aren't respected, and strong men do need to be respected. And, you know, I think that's important. So, you know, I don't know if I could grab Charlie by her face mask, but
you might cry, but Charlie.
I'll be crying.
I saw in your last, I think it was your last training camp, you had Andre Ward in camp. You trained with Virgil Hunter a bit, or you just had
I just went up there. I went up there and trained with Dre and Dre, Virgil.
Andre Ward, also another great champion that I really respect. And I not only do I respect him as a fighter, but I respect the way he did it. I respect the way he carried himself.
Yeah.
And the way that he carried himself from the start to the finish and went out. You know, talk to me a little bit about that. How was that being around?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, you know, Dre's always been open arms with me, and I think he knows, like, I take my craft real serious. You know, I'm not just out here just dicking around. So, you know, I think it was easier for him to want to have open arms for me. And anytime I have a question for Dre, or I feel like I need to reach out and get some insight on something, because, you know, like you're saying, he's been there and done that. And whether it's be in the ring or in life. And so him and his wife always been nothing but, you know, super respectful and nice to me and my wife, my whole family. So it was real cool to go up there in the Bay and train with Verge and Dre for a little bit before the Canelo fight. And, you know, just taking little tricks and tips on not only things, you know, how to handle things in the ring, but how to handle things leading up to that big moment. And, you know, I'm always grateful for that. So,
yeah. Well, my man, Caleb, you know, I want to say it's a pleasure to have you with us. It's a pleasure to get to know a little bit more about you, because like you mentioned, when you know you're quiet, So people kind of take that, oh, he don't want to talk to us. Oh, well, he think he's too good for us or anything like that. That's not the case. You know, you're just a reserve and obviously mindful of yourself. We respect that. I respect it a lot. You're a great champion. I think you will be again. So the way you've been carrying yourself, the way you've been fighting, I think you will be again. I just want to tell you, we appreciate your time. You know, obviously your lovely wife coming in. I think I seen her. She hit miss too. She throw them things too. I think I seen
She been in the boxing gym working out, but honestly, lately she's been getting into powerlifting competitions, and she won her first powerlifting competition somewhat recently, some months ago.
Yeah.
On the deadlift. What was the weight on the deadlift?
181.
140.
140.
132
at the time.
Damn.
Not
140.
My bad.
Okay. Some of
these
guys are like.
So yeah, she trains every day. So she's a beast. She's a beast. Not many people can keep up with JP. I promise you that.
Yeah. That's something too that's extremely important, especially now you're raising a child, and mommy and daddy are in the gym.
Yeah.
What's she gonna do? Sit at home and not do nothing? In the gym. So
yeah, no. JP's a beast. I mean, 100-meter hurdler and track for UNLV, full ride to UNLV to run 100-meter hurdles. And, you know, she grinds every day in the gym, out the gym, helping with, you know, everything we got going on. So it's a good, you know.
We appreciate that. We appreciate you, your family, everything you do. You know, I want to wish you more luck, more success. Yeah, man.
Thank you
for coming to speak in with us. You know,
oh, man, I appreciate you.
All right, my man, we just had the amazing Caleb Plant here. I knew there was a reason. There was something about him that I always kind of liked, and it's not only just liked, but it's something that I resonated with, and that was just his reserve. Like, he's very calm, he's very to himself, you know, kind of like I am sometimes. And I know I get asked this. I got asked this like a couple years ago. Like, I was at a Publix shopping. It's me and my daughter, and someone's like, "Bro, you shop here?" Like, they were like shocked that I was shopping by myself there. They didn't see an entourage. They didn't see all these people with me or whatnot. I'm like, yeah, I shop. I need groceries too, you know. And that's the thing with Caleb. He's just, you know, I don't need no entourage. It's just me. I got my wife, and I'm good, you know. And I like that about him.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. You can tell though, Kamaru, too, that he grew up super quick, super young. It's almost like he didn't have that Disneyland experience as a little kid. Like, it was straight up like, hey, man, this is how life is. We're going to use boxing to fight our way out of it. And that he did. I mean, you could tell, like, when we had that interview with him, that you can tell, like, there's a couple times where he got choked up, and particularly when he was trying to talk about his daughter. And I actually got choked up a little bit, too, because, you know, having one of them and then seeing him kind of, you know, having to bury your firstborn, your daughter, at, you know, at 19 months too, because that's at that stage where they're walking, they're talking, and you know, that's the pinnacle of when a man really starts to find that first love with that human and starting to see that creation.
Yeah, and him not, it just be him being robbed of that, not really getting that, because when she's being diagnosed and she can sit and doing all these things, I can't even imagine. And like I shared, because the first time my daughter had a cold. And I'm so connected to her to where I instantly noticed she was different. Something's wrong. It was bothering her. And it broke my heart. And that's just a cold. I can't even imagine a real sickness that's not getting better from. Henry, I was getting choked up too.
Yeah, and not just that, Kamaru too. And this is, I didn't want to kind of dive into it because, you know, because he's had a hard life, but also, you know, the fact that when we didn't get a chance to really talk to him about it, the fact that his mom was, you know, killed by a police officer because, you know, according to the report, she pulled out a knife, and then, you know, she ended up.
Me and him talked a little bit, you know, prior to, and there's, you know, she had her run-ins with, you know, mental health and some substance abuse and things like that. And, you know, that all these things are they're hardships. But are they hardships that shape us? Like I said, we're almost kind of like a sculpture. And are these hardships that kind of shave us and carve us to be as sharp as we possibly can to propel him into a stage where he gets to hear what many people never hear and knew. And then, of course, you get everything that comes with that, the money, you know, and the life. You know, now you have a wife. Now you're blessed with another child. All these amazing things that come with that. I feel like those hardships that we go through kind of scope us and shape us into it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it has, man. You can tell, dude. You can tell, like, his wife, like, he's found he found his love partner, which they both eat, sleep, boxing. Obviously, she's a commentator for boxing. She knows all about the sport. It's like, dude, he's been blessed so far from that kid who was raised in the slums of Ashland, Tennessee, to now, you know, having a miniature mansion out here in Vegas, having a world title.
How you know it's miniature?
I saw Countdown. It ain't no Floyd Mayweather mansion. I will say that.
Well, like he said, you know, he's not a man that needs all of that, you know, abundance. You know, he likes just being in his space, and I love that about him too. And I made a comparison of obviously how, you know, I got a lot of just kind of slack for that early on in my career, of being reserved and not being too braggadocious or boastful or you know, doing a bunch of magic tricks. Doing a bunch of magic tricks, you know, in press conferences. But it's just something about him, man, something about his spirit, the way that he carries himself. I still care about stuff like that. And I think, you know, as a man, when we're said and done and we're older and we're gray and time has passed us by, we can't do this anymore, and we're talking to our grandkids, you know, these are things that we're going to be proud of, is look the way I carried myself. This is how you should carry yourself. You know, so I
can't say that. Come on. I'm over here trying to become the first intergender world champ.
Oh my God.
No, but I think if there's anything that really surprised me about a little bit of Caleb Platt is he comes from the South. You could tell there's a little bit of that Southern gentleman to him. And, you know, he you know, when he started explaining that story with, you know, when he slapped one of the Charles and he slapped one of the other guys, it's almost like
it's a Southern gentleman,
there's warnings. No, but there was warnings that were given. And because, you know, outside of looking, it was like, this motherfucker just went up there and slapped him. Like, that's a bitch move. But then once you get the whole, you know, the whole facts on how everything kind of took place, I'm like, you know what? He's a fair dude. He really is.
No, he's, like I said, I the way he carries himself, he's a Southern gentleman for sure. But at the same time, don't test my gangster, because I will show you. And he has shown a couple of times the way he carries himself through fights, his wins, his losses, his ability to bounce back. You know, something I really, really, truly respect of him. And he was great. It was great.
Yeah, I loved it, man. That's all I got, Kamaru.
Well, guys, don't forget to like. Don't forget to subscribe. And guys, let us know who you might want to see next. Let us know, because of course we love to share our thoughts, our experiences with you guys. But we also love to hear from some of y'all heroes, some of our heroes as well. So don't forget to hit the like button, subscribe, and tell us who you want to see. And do it now. Go do it now.
Like right now.